Most people think of a steeplechase as a horse race. And yes, that's certainly where the term comes from. It is said that in 1752, Cornelius O'Callaghan and Edmund Blake settled a bet by racing 4 miles cross-country on horseback across County Cork in Ireland. Because there was no GPS, the finish line was the only landmark on the horizon, a church steeple in the next town over. And because there was no trail directly there, the horsemen needed to jump hedges, stone fences, and cross creeks and rivers. The original account of that race is said to live in the Drumlin Castle Library, although it doesn't mention who won. While many believe that's the first steeplechase, there's no doubt that over the next few decades, steeple hunting became popular across Ireland and Great Britain. When they couldn't find any foxes or stags to shoot on a hunt, they'd race to the nearest church steeple for some entertainment, again clearing hedges, creeks, and other obstacles along the way. In the 1820s, the term steeplechase was starting to be used to describe foot races, too. Most of these were shorter cross-country races, usually with hedges, fences, and of course, at least one creek, river, or moat, or some other water feature. Some of the historical examples include rivers that were more than 5 feet deep, which made it extra harrowing for those participants who couldn't swim. By 1868, steeplechases moved to a track, complete with barriers and, of course, a water feature. After that, it started to become a popular event in many sanctioned track and field competitions. While there was no steeplechase at the first Olympics in 1896, they actually ran two in Paris in 1900. And get this, the first Olympic steeplechase, which was 2,500 meters long, was won by a Canadian, George Orton of Strathroy, Ontario. Not only was it the first steeplechase gold ever, it was the first time any Canadian was crowned as an Olympic champion. Even though it was incorrectly attributed to the United States for 70 years, it was eventually rectified. There was a second steeplechase the next day, this time at 4,000 meters, where Orton finished fifth. This is episode 4 of See Thee Rise, Canada's Quest for the Podium. My guest today is Regan Yee, a 2-time Olympian, who is a specialist in the 3,000-meter steeplechase. She set a Canadian record in 2021 and also competes at other distances for Under Armour's professional team, Mission Run Dark Sky. Let's get to it. So joining me today, we've got a multiple-time Canadian champion in multiple distances and disciplines. Most recently, a 2-time Olympian in the 3,000-meter steeplechase. I guess originally from South Hazelton, BC, but that's not where we find you today. It's Regan Yee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me, Brian.
So first of all, I said you're from BC, but that's not where you are. So tell me where we find you today.
So I am currently in Flagstaff, Arizona. I know people think like, oh, super, super hot Arizona. But Flagstaff is kind of like a 2.5-hour drive, like up the mountain from Phoenix. So it is quite warm right now, but it gets cold in the winter. And the reason we're here training up here is for the altitude. So we're training at elevation. It's supposed to increase your red blood cell count, which then makes you able to more efficiently carry oxygen around your body for endurance events.
And so you're training there with a professional team, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So I moved up here in the fall of 2022 to join a professional Under Armour training group. So previous to that, I had been sponsored by Under Armour for a year, but I'd been in Vancouver working for the Vancouver School Board and training with my group. We all had jobs, so we'd meet up after work, and lots of them were working in the school system as well. So we'd meet up, train after work, and then, do our regular day jobs. But this opportunity arose, and I jumped on it.
So you're a full-time professional runner now, I guess, and Under Armour, and I guess the rest of your funding takes care of paying all the bills?
Yep, that's exactly right. The way that works is I train and compete for Under Armour. I wear their gear, I wear their shoes, and then they fully sponsor the team that I train with out here. So we have a coach, we have a physio, we have massage, we have a gym. And then, yeah, we have contracts with base salaries and then like a bonus structure that, if you have a good season, then it'll make you a livable wage.
Well, that sounds all right. I know a lot of the Olympians that we have, especially in Canada, have a part-time job or a summer job kind of when it's not peak season, and you can kind of train around that. So it's nice to actually, you know, make a living doing what you want to do. I did look up somewhere that you were a math teacher or were training to become a math teacher at some point. And I was wondering if that was still on the table or not.
So when I went to university, I graduated with just a general studies degree because I entered the education program like a little bit late. But I had done like most of my practicums and like most of the coursework for becoming like high school math teacher. So when I graduated from Trinity Western, yeah, I spent a few years working for the Vancouver School Board. Since I didn't actually have the education degree, I could work as a teacher's assistant, but not an actual teacher yet. So still working towards that. Like that's on the table for, after I'm done my running career. But I mean, this is not a sport that you can necessarily do your whole life. So I'm taking advantage of that now while I can, and then I can finish my degree at some point in the future.
So your specialty is the lower middle distance, can you call it that? The 800, 1500, 3000, 5000. Is there an ideal age for or a level of experience? What makes the best runner at those distances?
Yeah, so if you kind of look at like the historical trend for Canadian steeplechasers, usually they reach their peak like around their late 20s. And I'm just rounding into my 30s next year. That being said, I've also been healthy for my whole career. Like a lot of times injuries can interrupt your training. That can impact when your physical peak is and stuff. And I haven't had a lot of that. My first experience with injury really was like the month leading into the Olympics this year, which was pretty unfortunate. So typically, like as you move into your 30s, then runners start to like move up in distance. So yeah, 5K, 10K, half marathon, marathon. And because you can reach your peak for the marathon like into your 40s. I don't know if that's something I want to get into. Like the training for the marathon is just not something that appeals to me. Way too many kilometers.
I saw your Strava page. There's certainly no shortage of kilometers already, but I guess that would be three times, four times as much if you were training for a marathon, right?
At least double, yeah.
What was the injury?
So at our Olympic trials, so you understand like what steeplechase is. I feel like it's a pretty niche event, so maybe not everyone knows what that is.
I do, but for our potential listeners, why don't you fill us in and give us the overview?
Okay, sure. So it's 3,000 meters on the track, so that's roughly 7.5 laps. Each lap you have 5 barriers, which are just like sturdy hurdles, basically. And then one of those has a water pit after it. So it's like a slanted puddle. It's deeper at the end that's closer to the barrier. And then it like slants up towards the track. So you're trying to, jump as far out of that as you can, so you're not landing in the deep water. At Nationals I think it might have been the 5th water jump. So I still had 2 more to go after it. I slipped coming off of it. And kind of like overextended and tore a muscle like in my hip. So finished the race. I thought about dropping out, even though it was the Olympic trials, but like it was pretty painful. But luckily my boyfriend was there and he was on the backstretch, and I'd fallen into 4th place after the fall. And to guarantee your spot, you need like top 3. So he was like yelling. He's like, you could still do it. Like you could still catch them. Just refocus. Like you could do it. Which really helps. So the last 2 laps, I just gathered myself up. I was like, okay, I can get through 2 laps of pain, and cross the finish line in 2nd, which was super exciting. Then the next few weeks, which are supposed to be like the time where you're just like sharpening up for the Olympics, you know, I spent the next little bit, not being able to run, and then having to see physio, getting an MRI, and then Just trying to come up with a plan for how to get to the start line at the Olympics. So less than ideal, but we got there and still an awesome experience.
Yeah. So just sticking with kind of the logistics of the steeplechase, it may be a dumb question, but obviously you're used to running distances and obviously they're putting these barriers in the way. And obviously you have to go over them. And yeah, the water feature is something else altogether. But what is the, other than just the obvious, what's the hardest part about getting over these barriers, and why like, is it just fatigue that by the time you going over the 30th one, you just don't have, you're not quite as sharp, or does it mess with your rhythm of your pace? I'm just curious what the biggest challenge is.
Yeah. I mean, both of those things, and it's even like a mental thing as well. But yeah, physically, like, the best steeplechasers are ones that can just like glide over the barriers. They're very efficient. You're not like wasting time, like stutter stepping into the barrier. You're just like leaping over it and you keep going, because that's the most efficient way to run. And if you're constantly having to interrupt your gait or slow down or speed up, that takes a toll on you, and you can't run as fast for as long. So that's why it's super important to be able to pace yourself. Yeah, I mean, it is just a physical feat to jump over one of them, let alone 35 when you're trying to run like 3 minute kilometers. And then by the end of the race, it's also, like I said, like a bit of a mental game as well, because you're trying to make sure you're not expending too much energy and that you're going to be able to still get over the last few barriers, you know? So you're trying to convince yourself that, like, okay, you're not too tired, like you can still do it. I mean, it's fun and it's challenging, and it breaks up the race a lot. It doesn't feel like it's that long of a race because, yeah, you're just thinking about the next barrier in front of you.
And just to stick with that for just one more second, the water feature, like you said, it basically, you're jumping into a little mini pool that's a foot or two deep, and then you got to slosh your way out of it. It seems like people go down face first in that a lot. Is that fair to say, first of all, or is it just funnier when you see people in the water versus hitting the track?
I would say that usually there's someone that goes down in the water pit during a steeplechase race, you know, like statistically, if everyone's jumping over it 7 times and there's 20 girls in the race, then yeah, there's a good chance that someone's going to go down. And the thing is, for me, like, I had never had a problem in the water barrier before, especially when I was just in Canada, because typically, you know, it's like a more niche sport. There's not as many competitors in it. And I would usually be, you know, in the top three in the steeplechase in Canada. Whereas now that I've joined this professional team and I'm traveling internationally, I'm in Diamond League races, in international championships. There's a higher caliber of women, and there's a lot of women in front of me as well. And this season, actually, I think I had at least 3 collisions in the water pit, because I'm not used to having all these bodies around me. And when you have all these people in front of you and you can't necessarily see the barrier itself and you're running at a high speed into it and you're just kind of guessing or hoping that you're going to land with your foot on the right spot, because if it's slightly off, then that's how you trip or slip or something happens like that. So it's definitely hazardous. It's something that I've been learning to work with now that I'm at a higher level in the sport.
So how did you get into it in the first place? I saw that, you loved running, and like I said, you've got all these other distances on your resume, but why steeplechase?
So the first time I did steeplechase was at our zone championship, so in northern BC, and there was no one else in the race, so my coach was like, just like enter it, just try your best, just have fun with it, like automatic gold medal, and it might be something that is just a fun experience for you. And I'd never even seen a barrier before, so like before the race he showed me how to like step on the barriers, because you're allowed to do that, you don't have to hurdle, it's not as efficient, but I obviously didn't know how to hurdle, I've never seen a barrier before. So I entered the race, and everyone was cheering for me, and it was a lot of fun, and I ended up breaking the zone record. So he's like, maybe you have a bit of a talent in this event. So every summer I'd compete in it, and eventually I was making provincial teams with it, and then I was making national teams, and I got a scholarship through it. So it was apparently just a random skill that I had that not a lot of other people were maybe interested in trying, and I was willing to try it. So that's kind of how I got into it.
So let's go back to those Canadian trials where you've fallen into fourth place. You're trying to rally to get to that second place position. You said that you had to finish second to guarantee the spot. Is that fair?
Yeah. So like they can take three people, and top two though are kind of the spots that the selection committee locks in. And then the third spot is kind of like up to their discretion if you have standard or if you're in the world ranking. So yeah, top two was kind of like the safe spot for me because I was in the world ranking. Third, I still had a chance, but it was like more discretionary.
Yeah, so I was going to ask about there is an Olympic standard number that you're supposed to meet, right? And that if you fall short of that, you're not necessarily guaranteed your spot or something along those lines?
Yeah, so the way that they've done it now is that they have that Olympic standard, like the automatic qualifying standard, and the number is set so that their hope is that half of the field will qualify with that automatic standard, and the second half of the field will qualify through ranking, because they do want, obviously, to have the people who are just like the fastest, but then they also want people who are good at racing and good at competing. I think that's kind of the idea behind having this like two-level system. But yeah, like, standard, if my races had gone better this season, I lost a shoe in one of them, I fell into somebody in a water pit in another, and then slipped in nationals. So standard was like the goal for me, but then I was still safely in the quota anyways for the qualifying.
So you qualify for Paris, which is your mm-hmm. second Olympics. Everybody I've talked to who was there and who had also been to Tokyo was just night and day difference just because of what was going on in the world. You had fans in the stands, you had friends and family who were able to join you. Just talk mm-hmm. a little bit, what was your Paris experience like?
Yeah, like you said, night and day difference. I mean, in Tokyo, they had like cardboard cutouts in the stands and like fake cheering noises to like try and make it like a special environment. And I mean, you're still wearing the Team Canada kit, you're still at the Olympics, but just, you know, having your family there and having a packed stadium and like the fanfare of it all just makes it a lot more exciting, you know, and it makes it a lot more real. So this year, like, I will never forget that feeling of walking out into a stadium with 80,000 people. Like, it was like a deafening roar. Like, it was so cool. I've never had the chance to compete in somewhere, a stadium that was like quite that electric. And then, yeah, knowing that my family were in the stands cheering for me, even though my race was less than ideal, like, it still propelled me to that finish line. And just, it was a lot of fun.
Did you participate in the opening ceremonies on the whole boat trip?
Unfortunately, no. I think the only track and field athlete for Team Canada who went was Andre DeGrasse, because he was our flag bearer. But the rest of us, we were all in Barcelona in a training camp. Doing like our final prep in Barcelona.
That's too bad, because it looked like quite an experience. I'm sure you're watching from Barcelona, though.
Yeah, we were. They hosted like a little night for us, and yeah, they had the opening ceremonies up on a screen, and we had snacks and stuff, and it was cool to watch. But yeah, I feel like that was a once in a lifetime opening ceremonies. You know, like they really put a lot of thought and detail into it. It looked really cool.
It was a big swing, that's for sure.
Yeah,
trying to coordinate. I don't know how many thousands of people across, you know, miles of riverfront. So, yeah, it was something. So, you said you didn't have a great race. Obviously, you said before that you were just trying to focus on being able to start and run a good race coming off the injury. What are you thinking as you're running those laps in the Paris Stadium?
Yeah, so obviously you're trying to get into the mindset of like, okay, I need to make that final, because that was the goal for this whole season, was to make the Olympic final. And so, yes, there's like road bumps along the way, but you're trying to block all that out, and you're trying to just think like, okay, I can do it. I know I can still do it. Like, the fitness is there. And sometimes, yeah, you just need to have that one special race to make it happen. And so I did believe. I was like, I think I can do it. I'm pretty sure I can do it. And then once we actually started racing, every time I went through the water barrier, there was like a little bit of doubt in my mind, and I would get like, my stride would get messed up. I would stop. Like, I would do like a little 2-foot stop in the water instead of like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. And so even though I had trained hard and I was fit, if you're stopping like that once a lap and then everyone goes past you and you're trying to catch up to them again, it takes its toll. So yeah, by the last few laps, I was pretty gassed. And yeah, disappointed at the end. The CBC, journalists came out to interview us, and they couldn't even air mine because I cried so much because I was just so disappointed. But that's like just like immediately after, you know, like in the days afterwards, you can look back and be like, okay, I know I did my best with the situation I was in. I worked hard. Like, you can still be proud of that, and obviously my family is proud no matter what. But yeah, it was tough in the moments after to have these high expectations for yourself and not be able to deliver.
I can understand that. And now that you're training essentially full time, and you said going to meets and Diamond League, and I've just kind of been flipping through your Instagram before, going, it seems like you're traveling all over the place, competing quite a bit. How often are you on the road now?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in Flagstaff to train, so this is kind of like my home base now. Like, I don't know, I'm only in Canada for maybe like a few months of the year now, like Christmas holidays, visit my parents up in northern BC over the summer a little bit at the end of my season, and then yeah, back home for like national championships and stuff. But yeah, like we race quite often with this professional team. It's like starting in January, we'll be racing for the indoor season. And then traveling to a lot of races. Like last year, I went to China for a few meets, was in Europe for a couple months, doing the circuit out there, and Portland, LA, like New York, Boston. Yeah, traveled to a lot of places last year. So it's tiring and it's exhausting, and you definitely need a break at the end of it all. But obviously, like, super lucky to be doing what I'm doing, because there's very few Canadian athletes that get the chance to do this full time.
And with that in mind, do you see yourself, is there improvement in your times now that you can do it full time and it is your, you know, primary objective, that there's no distraction? Or have you seen a big shift in your performance, I guess is the question, from the time when you're training after school versus being on a full-time professional team?
Yeah. So I have run PBs like across all events now that I'm with this team. But this summer I was really hoping would be like the breakthrough, because that was my second year with the team. The first year, you know, like, yeah, you get to train full time, but it's like a new environment. It's full time at altitude for the first time. It's a new coach. It's a new team. Like, you're just kind of getting settled. And I ran well last season. But then this season, I opened my indoor season super strong. I ran like the second fastest Canadian mile time ever at the time, and the second fastest indoor 3000 meters at the time. I PB'd in the 5K indoors. Like, yeah, things were going really well, and it was like a strong start to the Olympic season. But then my steeplechase season, yeah, like, just something seemed to go wrong in every race. But I mean, yeah, I'm definitely in a better place. I'm more prepared for that breakthrough, you know, like, I'm less stressed. I have all the resources I need. And unfortunately it just didn't happen this past summer, but I have PB'd across all my events, and it's just a lot more fun being able to do it full time and not have to stress about, work and other stuff.
It does look like you're having fun. Basically, like I said, I was flipping through your Instagram. There's a lot of smiles, a lot of laughing. It seems like you've got a good group of people around you. I guess you don't post the pictures when you're miserable anyway, but it does look like you're enjoying yourselves, and the scenery is beautiful, and you get to travel to all these exciting places. So it does seem like you're in a pretty good spot now, and the performance is improving.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like you said, you don't post the stuff where you're crying necessarily. Like, that is a highlight reel that you're seeing on my social media, and yeah, behind the scenes, like, disappointed after my race, or like, I don't know, when I was training for the Olympics, like, I'd be crying after a training session sometimes because I'd be like so frustrated that this was happening now. You know what I mean? But yeah, overall, it's been such a fun experience. So yeah, lucky.
So you mentioned some of the meets you're going to where you did a 1500 or a 3000 or a 5K or whatever. How do you decide which races you're going to run on a particular weekend or which one you're training for at that, you know, at that particular time?
Right. So I leave it up to my coach a lot of the time, actually. But usually, like, you're also looking at, like, in the professional running world, which other athletes are going to be competing in those meets or in those races, because usually, like, the faster athletes that are there, the faster the race will go. So you want to kind of time your races to be at the same time as these other women. So sometimes, yeah, if we're targeting like a certain race that we know a bunch of other fast athletes are going to be running at, then we'll do like off distances. So if it's like a fast 5K, you'll maybe do like a 3K or a 1500 to like prep yourself for that 5K that's coming up, just to like sharpen it up a little bit. But not without, you wouldn't want to necessarily do a 5K before a 5K. You know what I mean? Like, you want to sharpen yourself up, but not tire yourself out for the major race.
And for that indoor season, they wouldn't really have a steeplechase event, would they?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's one race in Europe where they do like an indoor 2K steeple with no water. But other than that, yeah, it doesn't exist indoors.
So the other thing, I keep coming back to your Instagram because that's where I actually learned a lot about your training and your race history. And I mean, I looked at the World Athletics and Canada Olympic, all that stuff too, but the Instagram was actually more informative. You talk a lot about what you're eating, which I like. You have some interesting stopping to refuel mid-run as you're training. And the other one is that you've got a lot of video as you're running, and it seems, is somebody next to you on a bicycle or a motorbike or sticking out a car window? Because there's some really smooth video going at high speeds. How are you getting all that footage?
So we actually have a media guy with this team as well. His name is Noble Bouton. And that is actually one of like the major perks of training with this group, because like when you sign a contract with like a shoe brand, you have like certain responsibilities for like posting on social media. If you're just focused on training, sometimes it's hard to capture that content yourself. But here we have Noble, and he also runs. So honestly, a lot of those videos are him running beside us. He'll do like half a lap with us, and he's gotten very, very good at holding his phone super smooth to capture that content. For like lots of our longer runs, like we'll run up to like 25, 26, 27 kilometers for our Sunday runs. And so he'll come on either the bike or in a car, and we'll carry like our snacks or our drinks or fuel and stuff like that. So yeah, it's actually super handy.
That would be handy, especially because, like you said, some of the sponsor commitments, and you don't want to have to interrupt your training to do that. So it's nice that you got somebody else. You mentioned shoes, and one of the posts I saw was you'd packed, I don't know how many pairs of shoes for a particular trip. Is that because for a different race you want a different feel, or for if it's going to get wet in the steeplechase you want a different pair, or is it just because you like shoes?
Depending on the training session we're doing, we'll use a different shoe. So I mean, I have my one pair of spikes that I race in. Like you'll usually wear the same spikes for every race, but then we have like plated shoes if we're going to be doing like tempo work on the roads, or we have like a lighter weight shoe if we're doing a recovery run, or like something with more cushioning if we're doing a longer run on the roads and need the extra cushion. So yeah, like depending on what kind of training you're doing, there's a different shoe model in the Under Armour lineup for that, which I think a lot of people who just run recreationally would probably just have like the one pair of shoes that they use. We have different shoes for the gym, different shoes for every road surface, every trail, every track, different shoes for all the training stuff.
So how many different pairs of shoes do you think you have in the entire training lineup?
In my home right now, so my boyfriend's actually moving in, so I had to like clear out some of my shoes, but even so, I have like probably 40 pairs of shoes in the rotation right now. Some of them are like the same model and just like a different color depending on my mood or what color I want to wear. But yeah, lots of different shoes.
I mean, it makes sense if it's that specialized to whatever the workout of the day is, then yeah, you obviously need to dial in the right selection. But 40 seems a bit high.
Yeah, I probably need to get rid of a few more actually to make some room. His feet are size 13, so his are going to take up more space than mine.
No doubt. So you talked about expecting a breakthrough or anticipating one through the training here. I just looked at, you know, your times versus, you know, what the winners were, what the world records are. Is it, and then don't take this the wrong way, is it realistic to knock that much time off the performance that you're already putting out there?
So not the amount, like not a world record, like that's never, yeah, world record in the steeplechase is not realistic. This year though, like I think it was realistic for me to run 9:15 or in between 9:15 and 9:20 in the steeplechase, which still would have been like a 9 second personal best, which is a pretty big chunk of time. Especially just based off my indoor 3K time. So like usually the rule of thumb for converting between like a flat 3K and a 3K steeple is you add like 1 second for every barrier. So I ran 8:38 indoors, which kind of equates to, yeah, like mid-teens for the steeplechase. So that is what I was expecting this season, which I know nothing is ever like guaranteed. And yeah, that's kind of dangerous to like set those expectations when you're still 10 seconds off of the time, you know? But sometimes you just need to like think like that in order for that to happen, you know? Like if you think you're capable of it, then you probably are.
So you think that goal to get down into the teens, so which would probably be, like you said, 9 or 10 seconds better than your PB now. That's the goal. That's the reasonable one.
Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. Yeah. And especially as like shoe technology advances as well. Like I think that's going to play a role in it as well.
That's very cool. So is that, when, sorry, I got to get the question right here. When is the next event where you're actually going to be able to see the next stage of that progress? Is there a Diamond League coming up, or are you traveling to is there an outdoor steeplechase event coming soon?
No. So now like the fall season, we shift into like base training mode. So it's a lot more miles. It's not as much track work. It's a lot more like hill workouts and like really long threshold runs and stuff like that. And you kind of build your base. And then we'll probably do one race in December just to kind of like see where we're at. And then, yeah, we take our break over the holidays, come back in January, and then we start racing indoors, January, February, March. There's World Indoors in China next year. So that'd be fun to make. But then steeplechase season won't start until, yeah, probably April or June next year. So it's a long time to wait until my next steeplechase race, but a lot more time to get better as well and to get stronger and faster.
Are you running either, are they simulated, or can you actually set up a proper steeplechase course and get times as you go now?
I mean, we never really time trial it like that. Honestly, over the fall, we don't do a ton of hurdle work either, just because it is kind of hard on the body. Like every time you're jumping and landing, it's all that like force into your body. So we don't really start doing that until like the new year. Like the fall is usually just a time to like kind of regroup, strengthen, and then you start technique work in the new year.
Yeah. Do you still run cross country at all? Because I saw that was in a couple older posts.
Yeah. The last time I did a cross country race was at the World Cross Country Championships in Australia. It was 10 kilometers and then I couldn't walk for like 3 days. So after that race, I like swore off of it. Like, I don't want to do cross country anymore. It was really fun. It was really challenging. But like the hardest race I've ever done. So, I mean, I didn't do it at all last year. But yeah, you never know. Like there is, I do love a challenge. So, and I'm pretty good at forgetting pain as well. So I'm sure you will see me in a cross country race again at some point. This season, TBD, we'll see how the hip goes and recovery goes from that. But, yeah, at some point I'll probably get back into it.
I ran cross country in high school, and I think I hated every minute of it. I don't know why I did it. I'm not a runner, and it was not my favorite thing either. So I can relate to that. So you mentioned your hip. Is that still healing? Is that still something you're working on?
Yeah, I think it's fully healed now, but you know, like, your body kind of compensates when there's an injury. So there's just like other muscles that were like getting tight or getting sore or like limited range of motion. But yeah, now that I'm back in Flagstaff, I've gotten back into like a good routine with like physio exercises and our gym and like strength work and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think it's on the right track.
That's good to hear. I'm going to shift gears just a little bit, cause I saw another, feature that I think is pre-Olympics when you, were talking about, picking your school and you ended up at Trinity Western. You said, I think in that video you mentioned that there were NCAA offers on the table, and then you ended up staying in BC. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just talk a little bit about that decision and how that worked out.
Yeah, so that's another good thing about being in steeplechase is that, like, Americans don't really do steeplechase in high school that often. It's just, yeah, it's like more niche and considered like an upper level sport kind of. Whereas in Canada, we have like a whole progression into it. We like in grade 8, we start with like the 1500 meter steeplechase, and then they do the 1500 with water, and then they do the 2000, and then the 2000 with, like, yeah. So they build up to the 3000 meter steeplechase with water jumps. And so we have like a really good development program for it. And so I had, yeah, followed that pathway all the way to the top. And by grade 12, universities in the States and the NCAA were seeking after me to come to their schools, because it was just rare to have a steeplechaser that was already developed like that, you know? So I had tons of offers for Div 1, Div 2 schools. But like, being from a small town, I had no compass for where to go. Like, I didn't know how to sort through these schools. I didn't know like what criteria I should be looking at. And the whole thing was just super overwhelming. Like, no one from my school had ever gone to the NCAA Div 1. So I kind of just randomly picked a few schools to go visit. Ones that either like I knew other people from BC had like visited, like other of my like friends who were living in Vancouver or whatever. But yeah, that just, nothing really panned out. The school that I decided that I wanted to go to ended up pulling the scholarship, kind of. So they went from like 100% to 75% when they heard about my training. Because they're like, well, like, your mileage is really low. And you don't have like the training experience. Like, even though your times are good, your training is not at the level that like Americans would train at necessarily. Just in like flat distances. So yeah, they're like, you're kind of a risk, and we're not sure if you're going to like just break in our program. So they lowered the scholarship. But even then, for an international student, like, it was going to be impossible for me to afford that. So then my backup school was one in Texas, and my mom was like, you are not going to Texas. Like, no way. So they're like, just go to Trinity. Like, they are clearly really interested in you, and it seems like they're going to, yeah, care about you as a person and as an athlete. Whereas like in the States, I'm actually glad I didn't go there, because yeah, like that school said, they're like, they weren't going to change the program to like, for me to fit into it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, either you can handle the training or you can't handle it. Whereas in Canada, it's a lot more like, okay, we'll like meet you where you're at. It's more like long-term development kind of stuff. And you're, yeah, like nourished as an athlete instead of just like one of the 30 athletes on the team that they're trying to, place at a race. So yeah, it ended up being the right choice. My parents are right. stayed there for all 5 years, and, yeah, I'm super glad I did. And if you look at the Canadian women's distance team at the Olympics this year, probably 75 to 80% went to Canadian schools. They didn't go to the United States, and so you can kind of see like the long term development is there if you stay in Canada.
Yeah, and as part of that, you did the Universiad Games a couple of times, right? Mm-hmm. And represented Canada at the collegiate or university level stage. talk a little bit about that, because it's not something that gets a ton of attention. You know, when people are talking about how an athlete got somewhere, they frequently mention, oh, the Pan Am Games or the Commonwealth or the National Championships, but the University Games are kind of a whole circus of their own.
Yeah, and yeah, you're right. It actually is overlooked a lot. But for me, that was a major stepping stone because it was, yeah, it's basically like a mini Olympics. Like you're in your own little village. Like they have like housing built for you. Yeah, the stadiums are really cool. You get to go all across the world. So I went to South Korea for my first FISU and then Taiwan for my second FISU. And both were, yeah, incredible experiences. I did the steeplechase for the first one. And the 1500, the second one, which was, yeah, really fun to learn how to run rounds and qualify for finals. Like that was really fun. But yeah, for that age, it was like the biggest event I'd ever been to. And it was a good middle ground between like junior teams and senior teams, you know, because you're kind of in the middle of them and you might not be able to make like, yeah, the Pan Am Games yet. But it's a really good, yeah, stepping stone in between those two things.
Yeah, I've been involved with the winter version of that. I got to go to Spain for the University Games as the team leader for curling. So,
That's cool.
Yeah, I thought it was such an incredible event, but you don't hear very much about it. And even though, like you said, you're going all over the world, and it is a massive operation when you can kind of consider how many athletes are there and how many countries are represented. It is like a little mini Olympics, and it is a great middle ground for, you know, those athletes who are of the right age of kind of coming out of your junior ranks, trying to find your way into senior competition. And I just always find it fascinating that who has gone through that and what their experience was. That's cool.
Yeah.
Just a couple of fun questions is, what's something that happens at these meets or something that's normal that you have to deal with that your average fan would not consider? Like, what's it like? What's it like running in wet shoes?
Yeah, I mean, but I feel like your average fan might not even know what steeplechase is, you know? Like, when I came back from the Olympics, I was visiting my sister and one of her neighbors. He was like, oh, you're the Olympian. I was like, yeah. And so clearly she had like told him that like, oh, like she does steeplechase. It sounds like a horse event, but it's not a horse event. And he's like, oh, you're the Olympian. Like, yeah. Like, what event did you do? Oh, don't tell me. Pommel horse. I was like, like, I don't think women do that. And not quite. But yeah, it was just funny because I bet that that's what stuck in his brain was like horse. It sounds like a horse event, but it's not a horse event, you know? So yeah, I feel like a lot of people don't even know what steeplechase is in the first place. Have you ever seen that? Do you know who Leslie Jones is?
Yeah.
Okay. So have you seen her, her TikTok, on like steeplechase the first time she watched steeplechase at like the Tokyo Olympics?
I know what you're talking about.
It was
probably during the Tokyo Olympics. So it was a while ago, but I can imagine what that
what is happening here? And then like, there's a puddle or like, what are they doing? So I feel like that's most people's reaction. Like when they first hear about the steeplechase, cause it just sounds like such a wild event. But yeah, I don't know. That didn't really answer your question.
No, and it wasn't a really great question, so don't feel bad. But no, because there's some things where just things that are totally normal in your event that, you know, people tripping over the barriers, people falling into the water. It seems like it happens all the time, but yet when a casual fan of the Olympics turns it on, it seems like that's the kind of thing that they get blown away by. It's like, these guys just are eating it over the barriers here.
Yeah, yeah.
But that sort of thing happens all the time in your sport, right?
It does, yeah. I've jumped over a few people, like, who are submerged in the water pit, you know? Like, there's a lot of accidents that happen in the steeplechase. And luckily, I've never been a part of one that was actually, like, no one actually got injured from it. But yeah, to the casual observer, it looks pretty wild, I think, when they see someone just completely eat it in the water pit.
Is it, I mean, it's got to be super uncomfortable, especially if it happens to be early on that you're running the rest of the race and in wet clothes and everything's got to be a little stickier.
Yeah, I mean, one of my teammates, I won't mention his name because he probably wouldn't want me to say this, but he, so there's this like experimental kind, oh, it's not really experimental anymore, but this bicarb is like, it's been known to like reduce lactic acid. And so Morton has like a gel kind of thing you can buy and eat before you run. And it has like, it's basically like, yeah, baking soda, but like it's covered in like little gel things and you like swallow it whole. And then it's supposed to like, yeah, reduce the lactic acid in your body, but it can kind of upset your stomach sometimes. So one of my teammates like literally pooped his pants in the first lap of the steeplechase, but was wearing like split shorts, so it just stayed in there. But he said that those were like the worst laps of his life. Every time he like jumped over the water pit, he's like, oh God, like please let this be okay. So yeah, sometimes it's just there's stuff behind the scenes that's happening and we didn't know that it happened. We were like, why is he running like that? Like, oh, I hope he's okay. He looks kind of stiff. And then after he's like, yeah, I pooped my pants.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, sometimes there's things behind the scenes that you don't really know are happening.
Yeah, I've heard of Olympians doing that kind of thing, or marathoners and super long distance who just don't feel like stopping. But no, that's one that I didn't think I was going to hear today. So we'll wrap it up, but I want to give you a chance to kind of acknowledge the people or the sponsors or anybody who who's in the extended family here that needs some recognition. Who's helped you get where you are that needs a shout out?
Yeah, so Under Armour is obviously my major sponsor, and I wouldn't be here without Under Armour and their belief in me and signing me to their brand, which is huge. I'm also sponsored by More Rewards. I'm part of their like fueling sport program, which is really cool. Yeah, like Evan Dunphy, your one of your other guests is also part of that program, and that's it's huge. Just to have yes. To have a brand that believes in you and is promoting you, it just is a really good feeling, and it helps a lot with your own self-belief. And then obviously, like all the coaches I had growing up, the ones that didn't even know necessarily like how to coach steeplechase, but would like watch videos and stuff and like learn with me so that they could help me be a better athlete. And yeah, my family as well supporting me and my dad or my mom driving me like, I don't know, 20 hours round trip over the summer to get to races because we were like so far up north in like a remote town. And yeah, to run like a 6 minute race and drive 20 hours, like I would not be here without parents that supported me like that. So yeah.
That's great. So what's next for you? Obviously, you're still training with the team, in Flagstaff. What's the team called? Is Mission Run?
Oh yeah. Oh, so it, yeah. Under Armour, Mission Run, Dark Sky Distance.
That's a mouthful.
It is, yes.
So would other brands like, I don't know, Nike or Reebok or whatever, do they have their own team that you kind of run into at all these meets?
Yeah, so there's a lot, yeah. Even within Flagstaff, there's like a Hoka team called Nazalite. The New Balance team comes and trains here like for a large part of the year. Nike sends their teams up here sometimes. So yeah, even just in Flagstaff, you'll bump into to other groups.
Is it like gang warfare? You got to stay on your turf.
No, everyone's pretty friendly. There are a few groups that are pretty secretive. Like they have their Strava set to private, and you're not allowed to like hop into their workouts at all. But our group is pretty open. Like, yeah, we'll let anyone come in and hop into a workout or two if they want to, and see what's going on and train with us. So yeah.
So going back to the original question, what's next? What's coming up for you?
Yeah. So yeah, training up here for the fall, and then. Yeah, next year is another World Championships year, which yeah, it's not the same as an Olympic year. It does not get the same type of attention. Like sponsors aren't as interested in a World Championship as they are as an Olympic year. But it's yeah, still a major event and what I'll be working towards for next year. And yeah, we'll just see how the fall goes in terms of training. I don't have any real races on my schedule yet. But yeah, so basically just getting back to basics and putting in some hard work.
Well, I now follow you on Instagram, so I get all the updates. And like I said, I'm jealous of some of the places you got to go. I'm looking at St. Moritz right now. And then obviously there was Paris and wherever else. So Looks like a Flagstaff looks like a nice place to train too. So there's a lot of nice scenery out there.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely a lot different than Northern BC. Not a lot of water or greenery, but it's beautiful. It has its own charm, and it's a great place to train. Endless dirt roads to run on, and obviously lots of other elite runners up here. So yeah, it's a great place to train.
Well, that sounds good. I want to thank you once again for taking the time. I really enjoyed the conversation, and we'll be watching to see what happens next. Is the LA Olympics part of the plan?
At this point, yes. That's still 4 years is a long time though. So we'll see how things go. But if I'm still having fun with it and things are still going well, then yeah, definitely that'll be the next goal.
Well, we hope to see you there, and we'll see how that goes. And maybe if we do get to that point, we'll chat again before that.
Great. Sounds good, Brian.
See Thee Rise is a Left Button production. Follow us on Instagram at SeeTheeRisePod or email us at seetheerisepodcast@gmail.com.